Testing, 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 testing. It's about halfway up there. I don't know how loud her voice is. Well, it keeps going up and down, so I don't know. I've got the mic quite a ways away from the mouth, which is actually a lot easier for me, but I don't know how it's going to sound, so. I think you're going to be able to hear the clock, so I think I'll take that down. Vessel, container, I don't know what you would call it. Let's see how we're going to go here. I'm going to be holding this, the mic, and I just need for you to just talk for a minute to see how this is going to, because I have to make sure it's not,
okay,
that it's doing properly here. So just maybe just start and say, I am.
I am Kantali Thammavong. I am a Laotian from Vientiane, Laos. Okay, talking about the meaning of my name, so it's the only first word is means the bowl, but Thali doesn't mean that much, so therefore that's all just the meaning of the my name would be provided at this point. So part of the town that I came from is Vientiane, Laos. As probably a lot of people know, where Laos is situated is east of Vietnam and north of Cambodia. And I came from the small town in Vientiane. My parents were born in the suburb area, but then moved to the capital just because of my dad has a job in the capital, in the town itself. A lot of people asking about what the difference between the Hmong, the Lao, and the Mien. So we all people from Laos, and they are Laotian, but different ethnic group. The Hmong and the Mien are one of the major ethnic group that in Laos, and in Laos we have so many, a lot of people say that between the range between 18 and above ethnic groups in Laos itself. And then I'm the Lowland Lao one that came actually from Vientiane. Can I pause this one?
Oh, yes.
See how it's like, and then we can record it again.
Yes, you can pause. But you can just keep on going if you think of things that you want to talk about. So do the Laotian people have the same language and so forth as the Hmong and the Mien? How are they different from the Hmong and the Mien?
The language is completely different. I like sometimes you heard a lot of people say, how come majority of Laotians speak Thai? Because there's pretty close language. But for the Hmong and the Mien, they're completely different. So there's no similar word at all.
So the Hmong and the Mien, really their language comes more from Chinese.
That's what they believe that it was.
And so your father worked in a business?
No, he was working in a bank. A bank.
And your mom?
My mom is just housewife. No job, because she is raising five girls, and then that's been her major job for her life, married life.
So you had no brothers?
No brothers. I'm the oldest one out of five girls. And right now, 3 are here in Poland with me, and 2 are still in Laos.
Do the ones in Laos intend to come here, or will they stay there?
They tend to stay there, but once in a while they had the ability to come and visit because of they came to visit our mom at the time that she was not able to go back to Laos yet. Right now she became citizen, she has the ability to go back and to visit. Right now she's still in Laos and have not been back yet.
So she's visiting Laos, she's but visiting she Laos. Will come back
yeah,
here.
Yeah, she will come back. She'll come back, but she seems to prefer over there more because of the weather. So Oregon is still a little bit cold town and comparing to Laos.
And when did you leave your country and what caused you to leave?
My husband, I, and one daughter and one son at that time, who was 4, my daughter was 6 and my son was 4, we left Laos in August 1980. The reason for to flee Laos was my husband was a officer serving the old Lao government. And after they gave him a chance to finish his education in under the new Lao government regime, and they want him to go and teach at a place far away from our family. So we had sort of realized that in our whole life, we're not going to be able to get a chance to be the whole family. So we decide to go at that time.
So he had been educated in a re-education camp?
Right. During, 1976 to 78, he was taken to one of the re-education camp, which is about, I would say, 50 miles from where we live. And after 3 years, and they had realized that he get the opportunity to be able to be re-educated under a different field, which is in a agriculture. When he graduated, so he'll not going to be able to become a police officer again. So that's for the, for the new government, they say that he would be safe and not really be threatening to the government to be able to, have some rebellion ability anymore. So
the re-education camp for him meant school and what else?
It was, in the reality, it was not quite a school, but it's just a place where they will keep the people that who they can do a force label, giving you a little bit of a new philosophy, how the new government is running, what is rules and how it's supposed to be and how you should believe in sort of sacrifice your self and prioritize between your own personal life, or you have to sacrifice your life for the communities and the country.
So he didn't actually get skills that say he could use here in the United States.
Not from that camp itself, but after that, after 1978, so they allow him to go to the agricultural education agricultural school. We called for 3 years, and then until he finished. Actually, it's only two years.
So he decided that you were going to leave Laos, and who went with you, and how did you make that journey? Tell us about your journey.
Okay. So let's go back a little bit about the chance that we could have left the country earlier, but we decided not to. In 1975, my husband was a policeman, but he was working in the immigration unit in He worked at the airport, so as a immigration officer. Then we were told by friends and French, the boss says that his name is Sitok, They say, well, CETIC, would you want to consider leaving because this is going to happen? You know, we give you a chance, so we'll give you family the whole ticket to fly to France directly in 1974. And he said, no, I don't want to go yet. I still like my country. I don't think that I will be any harmful to the new government people, so I'm not really that high rank officer. So that's how he decided to stay and then give up that chance that we, the whole family, would just, you know, be flying on a, you know, to France directly at that time. And so throughout those years, that's what we realized, that death's not going to be any hope, no future, even though we believe in the, you know, we say we love our country, we want to stay, we want to be contribution to, you know, to them. But at the end, after this many years, and they're still going to keep us apart, wife in one town, husband in another town, the kids will not see the parents, no really hope for the future. So that's why we say, okay, let's leave. And I leave everything behind on August 1980. It's the process of leaving the home, that's not that easy, because you don't want to get suspected. And then if you do, if you got caught, they're going to put you into the jail, in the another camp, or send you away for who knows when you're going to be able to come back. So we just doing a small plan by moving from our home, selling that. We say we want to give our house to take over by our sisters, older sisters. Then we move in a little bit closer to town, which is in my parents' house. We lived there for 3 months, and then after that we sort of arranging people who taking the job as fleeing, you know, the people across the Mekong River to the Thailand camp, which is somebody we know, you know. So you don't just take anybody, you have to know the person well, because your whole family life is at risk if you're not knowing the person well, because there were a lot of robbery and a lot of killing at that time that we heard of, you know. So
this is a guide who helps you walk to the Mekong?
Yeah, he would arrange, be the one who arranged the boat, but we had to pay per a certain amount per adult, per child, whatever, so in order to make sure that we save across the border.
So you didn't do any walking, you simply took the boat?
No, we do. Okay. So we have, let's see, night before that we're going to leave, the person will just come inform us that how you folks going to make across, no, I mean come from your home to the river border, Mekong border, where everybody will arranging the canoe. I call it canoe. It's not a boat, because boat is big. This canoe is going to fit like about, to be safe, maybe 5 or 6. But we ended up by having like 14 to 15 people. So
you had 14 or 15 people in the canoe.
That kind of average size canoe. The reason why for that is the there is not that many, and everybody wants to go, and you want to take a chance. So, you know, other people too want to take a chance. So, okay, let's do it. Rather than not taking advantage of or at all. So my husband's situation is pretty good, because he had to ask a permission from a government, local government, says that we're going to go visiting our relative in that town. Is a good plan. So otherwise you would be so scared that if you don't have any excuse. But throughout the transportation process, we have to go into this big truck, you know, like the it's be like a bus, but in the bus over there is not the bus like here, but you sort of a truck, and has this long rows of you know, place where the people to sit. It fit maybe 30 to 40 people in one trip, because it's a long distance commuting. So my husband get a permission from the school. At that time, he was still in the school, and then in the agricultural school. Because if he say, I want to go back to visit my town, but let me get your authorization to say I'm going to go visit so-and-so and for my relative's wedding. So they gave him a letter, you know, because he'd been acting good for the last 3 years, or he almost graduated from then. But he got told that, okay, once you graduate, we're going to be sending you to a certain province in very north of Laos to be a teacher, you know. So that's how he say he's not happy with that. So let's go plan to do the escape. So late at night, we spend the night there in my father's house and do the packing. We can't take much belonging with us because it's going to be pretty inconvenient. So maybe one bag, small supplies that's necessary for one day. And we know that when we go across the Thai border, we're going to be able to get some new supplies. But we had to, you know, get some money and a small amount of jewelry or whatever you have, or estate. Then early in the morning, like 5 o'clock in the morning, so you have to, my father would took us to drop off at the station, the bus station. So it took about 4 hours, normally 4 to 5 hours, to get to the Mekong border, that village by the Mekong border. In the middle of the road, we had some incidents that police patrol, I call police patrol, you know, the street patrol, road patrol, stop our track. And say, we're looking for a lady by the name Mrs. Green, you know. So we sort of were so scary because we're the one who also is going to escape, you know, like what we do here in case. My husband said, don't worry about, because we have the permission, so nothing's going to happen to us. They just, with the gun in front of you like this, okay, now left up your hand, left up your face, or lift up your face so I can see who you are. Some people have wearing the hat, you know, this little hat, so they don't want to see the face. So they look it up and say, okay, oh, you don't look like the one in the picture. So they have the actual picture, actually. So we thank goodness that it's not us. So we were safe, and then we get to the village, okay, but the bus would not go into the village. We have to walk another 2 to 3 miles. Myself, my husband, with the young kids at that time, you know, I imagine that the kids never go to a long walking distance, so it's pretty difficult. And then we stay at our relative's house. You call relative, it's not relative, really, but we do have the real relative there in that village, just to make it a plan that going a little bit smoother, you know. But the person who we hired, we want them to say, here's what we want to leave as a departure place. So they're the one who will need to arrange it with the canoe. But we know someone in that town too, just to be safe. We don't want to do a big risk. So all of his plan, and you can see that it took us a long time to really come up with the plan. So at night, after dinner, they'll make everybody come load the boat, load the canoe. That's how we ended up by seeing that, where is these people coming from? We thought it's only our family. You know, 4 or 5 or 6 people, right, in that canoe. And then you ended up by having like 14, 15. And the guy who we hired says, okay, don't worry about it. It's okay. And everybody wants to come, and you want everybody to get the chance, right? And we just feel like, I know, everybody want to leave. So let's do it fine. So my son, since he was 4 at that time, he was crying, afraid, because he see the water. And even though I gave him the coughing medication at that time to make it sleep, but I probably didn't give him enough dose, and he wasn't sleepy. He was crying. And we have to cover his mouth until he was tired, so he didn't cry at that time.
What if you wanted him to sleep, you didn't want him to cry, because who might
hear him, and how might that be a problem?
Okay. If you're making a scene, like either kids cry or the soldier or, you know, communist soldier, people in the village see that, they would shoot, they would kill. So 14, 15 life over there would be at risk. Out of that trip, we are the only one who had the young kids. The rest of them are all teenager, young people that will come along on our trip. So we realized that this, in order to make it, you know, pretty quiet, we have to do some other ways to not having any kids cry or any yell or scream. So my daughter, who is six, and she's understand that a little bit, she sort of obey, but the young one would not know. So that's why I gave him about a couple of hours earlier than the time that we know we're gonna board with this cough syrups. So assuming that he will be sleepy, but unfortunately it probably wasn't a good dose. So he was scared and was kind of cry a little bit, but we were able to make him quiet. And then through some incidents that we heard that happening to other people too, prior to that too, they even killed the kids. Not intentionally, but accidentally, because you try to cover the app, but you didn't realize you covered the nose because you don't want the child to cry. Because if other people come with you in the same trip or same boat or same escape, you know, plan. So that was how it was very traumatic, as I called. A lot of people, when we come across to United States and people were interviewing you later on and says that what kind of life and experience you have had, all of this is still in you, and sometimes it come on a nightmare, but we try to cope with it, and we know that's how it was, and then we know that we were thankful that we were alive, comparing to other people that got killed in the middle of the Mekong River. It happened. It really happened, because it happened to our close relative too, that when we came, we didn't see them, and we didn't know who it was, what would happen. So would we know that they're taking another boat another day, you know, but never make it, because they are people that who sometimes you hired, they rob you too. But how are you going to help, because in the middle of a Mekong, they just flip the boat and they walk away with your belonging.
How far is it across the river about? How long would it take to take that journey? I mean, how far from one part, you know, from one side of the river to the other?
This is the place we took, we attempt to cross. It was not that wide. That I would say, how would you measure here?
Like the Willamette?
Double this.
So like the Columbia, maybe.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Yeah, the wider part would be about the Columbia, you know, at the narrow place. But we took it to the place that's not too wide, but quite further from town, so we hope that nobody will follow. And especially this guide who we hired know the other part across, too. So they had arranged the people already, so.
And then how far is it from the river to the refugee camp?
Oh, quite far, quite far. And but
do you walk or?
We after we arrived at the other side, the other border, and how you call it, the river side. The folks at who come and pick us up took us to a village chief in Thailand. That's we spent one night over there until the bus took us to the camp.
Okay. Mm-hmm. So there were then mm-hmm. buses to the camp.
Yeah, the buses to the camp, because of they probably has been an arrangement that whoever identified as a refugees has to bring them to the camp. That's as they're probably the rules in Thailand at that time.
And briefly, how would you describe your life in the camp, especially from the point of view of a woman with children?
At my time, I was pretty fortunate to have our family came in at the time where the camp were pretty much like almost empty. There was a policy at that time, shortly before our arrival, that the Thailand people stop the border crossing. That's why for our time it was very dangerous, because we were cross at the time that the government, two governments, says that I want to stop the border crossing. So whoever come, I'll shoot, you know. So because of they taking out people out from the camp, the first camp that we were, you know. So there are two camps that you have to be in. First camp is a temporary, and then after that they move it us to the Pananikom, you know, Pananikom, that's another camp, that's the main camp that where the refugees wait until they transition to the third country. The first camp was a primary one. We stayed there for 2 weeks, and after that they move us into the big camp. The smaller camp and the bigger camp, now at the time we arrive, there's not that many people because of they're already evacuating out. They plan to close the camp.
So then your time there wasn't too uncomfortable?
Wasn't too bad, not too crowded, you know. But the sanitation, as you know, so it's only a temporary camp. Where you're going to ask for the luxury? No, you had to stay there and then get the food where the daily distribution is and whatever, you know, they give you. So you had to live by that. We just believe that it's going to be a temporary situation.
How long did you think you were going to be there?
My husband, as soon as he got into the camp, because he was able to speak English a little bit at a time, so he went in to work with the camp processing officers. So they told him that it wouldn't be a long wait for him. As soon as American people were opening the processing, it will be the first priority. So even that, we were there like for six, seven months.
You said your husband was in a re-education camp and that he didn't get that many skills that would help him here. What was his experience when he first came to this country as far as finding work and getting adjusted to life here?
For our family, we thought we are in the much better situation somebody else, because my husband had friends who came in and lived in Portland, Oregon as the first refugees group in 1974. And he was the one who, as soon as heard that we were in the camp, he would try to sponsor us here. So when we first came, he was the one who helping us to look for a job. At that time, we have a resettlement agencies already. Like, we came through USCC, which is helping us providing.
What is USCC?
It's a I think it goes by Catholic Charities, but I'm not sure what they call USCC for.
It's okay, but Catholic Charities.
Catholic Charities is one of the resettlement agencies that helping people in local. Even though I said that we know how to speak English some at that time, but it's just not to the standard point that comparing to, you know, United States, because going to finding a job, so it's going to be hard. So we know that we need to go back to school a little bit for a few months and continuing to learn English before we get a job. And my husband also took a machinist training for a year, but I got a job before him at that time. So because I started my first job with as a translator, because I, like I said, I know English a little bit. My education there in Laos was like 16 years, and I got a bachelor's degree there in education. So we had some, even though my major language at that time was French, but we had the English class like two hours per week. So it was pretty helpful. See, if I knew that I would come to United States, I would just go to like the English classes, like, you probably hear two mix one and other people selecting the major in English rather than French.
So So your skills helped you get a job. And was your first job with ERCO?
Mm-hmm. It was my first job at ERCO at that time. And
would you tell us what ERCO means?
Okay, ERCO stands for, it used to change the name though, right? Now the current name would be Immigrant and Refugees Community Organization.
But first it was?
International Refugee Center of Oregon. So they just recently changed it to keep the same acronym, but it stands for a different meaning. Immigration and Refugees Organizations of Oregon.
So the
organization.
So the focus now is not just on refugees; it's also on immigrants.
Right. And the focus is on they want to broaden the service to cover the immigration or the immigrant as well. So that's why the policy said changing the name to, you know, encompass this group also.
What had you heard about America before you came, and how close were those stories to the reality?
Oh, that is another experience. Well, at the time when we were in Laos, right, we study history and we study geography and American. And we just imagined that we would walk in, if we would ever have a chance to walk in to a land that would be like so high buildings, big town, nice, clean, and this, what they call?
Skyscrapers.
Skyscrapers. Okay, that's my experience. And then for our experience ourselves, we sort of had to wait for the plane to Portland. We stay in San Francisco for 2 days, but in the camp. They're still in the camp. We couldn't get out. We couldn't go to visit.
In a camp? Or
In the arranged place for transition, transitioning. So it's in an apartment complex that they arrange it for refugees to stay there until they find the plane to their final destination. Like us, we'll be coming to Oregon, Portland, actually. So we were stay there for 3 days, I think 2 days. Uh-huh. But we didn't see much about what we see in this is kind of, you know, high-scaping buildings. And the time that we had to flee to Portland, Oregon, the pilot would say, oh, now we're almost close. And at night, we came down like a little bit in the evening, maybe 5 or 6 o'clock in March. It was kind of cloudy and raining. And I tried to look down. I was sitting by the window, seat, and then tried to see how it's like. Where is it? And I didn't see it except just the sky and all of these greens. And I say, where are we going? So we happened to land in Portland, Oregon, which is a small area at that time. My friends live in Gresham, and you can see that, you know, from the airport to Gresham. We just tried to look for a high building, and we didn't see it. That's our first impression for the United States.
So you were disappointed because no skyscrapers.
No skyscrapers, no large building, no big place. So that's how our first experience. Mm-hmm. And then later on, a few days, and then my friends took us to downtown. Of course, we would see. But still, Portland is considered a small town. So I still continue to be disappointed, too.
So have you been able to travel in the United States?
Yes, through my job. And I was able to go to a conference in different places like D.C. and Fort Worth, Dallas, and down to Florida sometime in, several states that I've been. So now I've seen it. And then we still like Portland, Oregon, because it's quite a town, even though I don't like the weather that much. My coworker said, Kathleen, you've been here for the last 24 years, and you still feel too cold? Cold hand, cold feet, and then not able to cope with, you know, rain. So I said, not. I still have the warm the warm blood.
What would you say has been your happiest experience since you've been in Portland?
I would say the opportunities, as I said, comparing to the first day that we tried to escape, as I described my experience earlier. And we said, well, here we are, we're alive, and we bring the two kids in with us, and In fact, I have one more, you know, one little child here that who is now 18 years old, that who is an American, you know, born in here. And we will be able to give us the chance to put our kids in to the school. Now my first daughter is 30 years old, and she is a graduate, and she's a nurse having a good job. And the youngest one now is 18 and going to be graduating June 18. So I can see that now the up and down in my life too, and I have not described it all, but number two is still a little bit working on it, and it's been a challenge for him because of we came in at that time in the group that we did not know what the parenting and how are we going to cope with the life in the United States, and so therefore I didn't quite have success with the number two. But even that, at least we learn out of this experience that there will be an up and down, and if we the first earlier come, how would our experience be, and so how are we going to be able to tell the newcomers, say, what to do, how to prepare themselves, and working with the community here to make them understand that we are coming to be part of the society, be a good contributors, and learn their culture and share our valuable culture so we can both, all of us, live in harmony and have a good understanding and be a, you know, good contributor in this New Portland area.
How important is it to you that your children retain the values that you learned when you were growing up in Laos?
It's a challenge because they go into school and they're going to have to learn the new way how the school is here. Even though the parents we have be able to stay with them for after the school, but seems like the time is pretty limited. But we're trying to retain, like they show them, we still have, we are Buddhists, and we still have pagoda that they can, the temple, the Lao temple, that they can still go visit once in a while, that we're still doing that practice, the religious ritual or ceremony. Once in a while, I'm trying to ask them to come, but they do not want to do that, and then have them be able to speak with them in Laos at home is still going to be a difficult challenge too, because sometimes they don't want to talk to you, they say, but we force them to. At least you can see the beauty in here. People who are bilingual will be pretty good. We're very helpful. So we want them to be able to speak some, so that at least they can address the older ones, and they can communicate with the younger ones. So at least they'll be like able to get along or socialize with any generation. So that's what we were trying to do here.
The Vietnamese have formed their own school for children to learn the language, to be able to read and write the language. Do you think the Lao group in Portland will do that?
It has been. It has been done before, but sort of sometime it's to the point that you get started and get going for a while, and now there's lack of participation, and the group was giving up, and now when they have another group, so they sort of launched another one again and kind of dripping out. So that's how we are. But just in general, would be trying to tell you that we are attempting to do that, you know, as an older generation, we want to maintain our culture and language, at least to pass it down to the younger generation. Like, we had a chance to, a few years ago, for my family, and we sent our daughter to go visit Laos, and she was so happy that she left at 6 years old, and now she went back and doesn't remember much, but at least to sort of it's enrich your knowledge and ability to open up, to accept it, what is to be like a crossing cultural person. So for the younger one, we're trying to do that as well. It's going to become pretty hard because if your hair look black, but you say, I'm American, this is going to be a challenge for this new generation to be accepted in the society and accepting themselves too, that don't forget, you know, as long as you're not getting the hair, why they're going to see, first of all, you're an Asian, so. They have to kind of learn how to cope with it. But it's, I've seen it as an advantage.
Have your kids or you or your husband had to deal much with discrimination or prejudice since you've lived here?
I would say a little bit. But as I said, my son, he is now in, we put him in a Catholic school. A little bit more of a challenge for us, but we feel like that might be one of the avenue. We could have decided wrong on that one, but since we lost, we didn't lose, but we did not succeed with the first son, as I mentioned a little bit earlier. So we thought maybe this is another way to prevent that. We can put him in a smaller school. So as I said, the first seen him, they still see him. Oh, look at that Laotian soccer boy. You know, he's in a soccer game. He's in practice in the sport, soccer sport. So that we get teased a lot. And so you can see that now we're small, but not the big discrimination like we get yelled at or something, not in that way. But we heard from other people that who have had experience, so that they get yelled at, say, you know, go back to where you belong, and you know, but it didn't happen to us. But it exists in the community.
What about your middle son? Do you think he may have experienced more than maybe the rest of you?
I would say that probably did. That's probably make him kind of, you know, going back into that group, that it's not be able to succeed in the community.
And you work at ERCO with people from Laos today, with refugees. And I'm wondering, since you've worked at ERCO, how many years?
Since May 82, so I was...
So you've watched the whole group come. Tell us about the changes that you've noticed in the people and their problems.
It's in the, like, 80s, I would say, that we have the Southeast Asian, and after that, we don't have that many anymore. But still, there's some Vietnamese group, and we still have seen Burmese in terms of Southeast Asia, some Cambodian, but little coming in Portland. The majority are now changing in like ethnic group or people from a different nationalities and countries. So they have something I learned out of it is each group from each country, from each region, have some unique cultures and experience that they brought it in. So as a worker over there, and we have to learn how to cope with it and be able to, like, comprehend it ahead of time. And once in a while, we have a cultural presentation through ERCO too, just to make us be aware of how to deal with this particular group. That's kind of make it a good... successful, and then we don't have to go through a lot of, like, you know, going around. We can go through a shortcut in helping them. So, like I said, part of, in general, the refugees is been you know, experience for the refugees would be like a challenge to cope with a new life. How to make a change from what you learn from experience to the new ones in order to keep going, that is a big challenge. I would say through every ethnic group, to every people from every nationalities, even though they have had experience or no experience at all, there will be a certain degree that they have to cope with this new society. That's what it would be, kind of rating the success, how people would do it successfully. So that's where that how they be able to pull themselves through that challenge.
So now you don't really work with Laotian people. You work with people from other ethnic groups that are coming in.
Right, right. Okay. Just because of the change in the refugees, flow. And
how do you think Laotian people are doing in Portland today, generally?
I would say pretty good, and we're so proud of it. Like last Saturday, we got invited to a graduation of one Laotian woman who just got her doctorate diploma to be specialized in how you call this, the people who administer the anesthesiologist.
Yes.
So that's what, you know, and we had, and you can see that all of these people are showing up and give her support, and we're trying to talk in our community, say that, okay, look at this, you know, model, look at this family, and how we're going to be able to supporting our kids to, you know, encourage them to go forward, and so at least, and then they can help each other, and then helping the community as well as, you know, like the society at large. It was a fantastic things, and, you know, very encouraging.
What changes would you say are the most difficult that you have to make when you make this huge jump from one country to another? What are the most challenging changes that you've had to make?
I would say pace. Pace in terms of keeping up, holding many tasks together and roll it along with the time that American people experience. For example, I can say, you can see, probably heard a lot of Laotian people say the rubber time, right? If you say you're going to go to an appointment at 10 o'clock, so you're showing up at 11 o'clock and all of that. So now it's a big learning, says that going out on time, every minute counts, and how you're going to be able to kind of struggle between family, and if you have many kids, unfortunately, I only have two, that is pretty manageable number, but some are, as a Southeast Asian, you have four or five kids, and how you're going to be able to, like, working with school, and how you'll be able to get to go to a parents' orientation or parents' meeting in order to know what your kids, how they're doing, you know, and also you have to work full-time in order to bring the income to the families, and how you're going to be able to keep up with the kids, when, how to plan for their education, the future, how to do all of that, you know. So, and then what you're going to do to save some money in order, when you're getting older, you're going to be able to have some income too for the family. So you can see all of this, like many tasks that you have to do, and then do it on time too. You cannot wait like 5 more years. You're going to do it at every single minute. There's a demand for you to do that. It's been a challenge.
I can see that. What kind of a future do you see for yourself, and what are some dreams you have for just you?
If I wish, and seems like I have been a pretty good, a stable position here for this job. I like working with people, so part of what I, my own experience, can contribute and helping the future generation or future to come as a refugees, and how to overcome the barriers and help them in their resettlement process. If this job or this, you know, industry will permit me to stay, I think I can probably stay for another few more years, and hopefully be able to retire early.
And so, how would you see your retirement? What would you do during your retirement?
Okay, I learned out of this new, you know, society here that when you have more time, you contribute yourself back to help the community, especially within my Laotian community, maybe in other refugees community that who may need my help. And also maybe going back to visit Laos, which is I long so much to go back again. Since I left, I only have the chance to go there in 2003, just to go to do my father's funeral. And I had only 1 week to stay, didn't get a chance to go see what has changed, and there's so tremendous change, and I want to go back there, visit quite often if I permit to. And one thing that I've seen, that when we came, we didn't seem to worry about that, you know, we miss the homeland. But when we're getting older, I don't know, that kind of feeling is coming back to you, that you long to want to go see your own country. So that's something that probably I hope other people had the same experience too. So, or maybe because you just like finish with so many things that as a test, and now we have more time to think about it. That could be true too. seems like you want to go back and you'll be able to go travel and see other friends and family that who you love in other state too, because when we leave home, we don't know who's where, especially you have classmate, you have relative in some other state that you have not been able to go there to.
Well, I hope your dreams come true. Thank you so much for doing this interview with me. I really appreciate it.
Well, thank you so much. And then it's an honor to be able to be part of this and share this experience with other people that who have had the same similar experience, or who might say, oh, that's not the way, it may be different than others, but I think that we have such a unique, experience and whatever we have, and we're trying to encourage other people to just strive forward and to succeed and, don't give up hope.
Thank you. Okay, let's see.
So an hour? 49 minutes?
Let's see. 50 minutes, yeah.
That's all.
Okay, let's see now. I'm going to...